The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Exciting news! October sees the launch of the world's first live healthy breakfast show right here on UK Health Radio. Presented by the amazing Dr. Shan Hussein every weekday from 7 till 9 a.m. Also live streamed via YouTube and available on UK Health Radio's Listen on Demand for our global audience. Start your day the healthy way.
Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Hello everyone and welcome to Recovery Today. My name is Jim Smith and Easter Monday today. That's I'm recording this on Easter Monday, so I hope you're all having a good bank holiday. And my guest this week is a friend called Kevin McInerney. And we've just been actually talking about Kevin's surname because it's quite interesting. I mean, I did a bit of mild research before, and I was telling Kevin that on Wikipedia, there's a whole page devoted to the McInerney surname. It's a noble Irish name. But go on, Kev, tell us about your beginnings and, where you grew up and maybe a bit more of about McInerney.
Oh, well, I'll tell you about my name first.
Yeah, Jim, do that.
A lot of people get confused with the pronunciation. And I generally say to people, the best way to remember how to pronounce it is think of it as two people. Think of it as Mac and Ernie.
Yeah.
Right. And I came across that concept of it when I was about 10, 11 years old. A school friend of mine invited me round to his place for tea, and his mum answered the door. And she said to me, where's the other one? And I looked at her, confused and bemused, and turned around and looked for the other one. I said, what do you mean? She said to me, well, you're Mac. Where's Ernie? And that's a great way to think about pronunciation of my name.
That really is, because I wasn't sure how to pronounce it, earlier. Right, well, your parents were Irish, were they?
Yeah, both my parents come from the west coast of Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
And my dad came here and my mum before the war. My eldest brother was born in 1939, the war broke out.
Oh, yeah.
And I've since discovered they weren't married at the time.
Mm.
And my dad joined the British Army. As you know, Ireland were neutral in the war, and he had the choice to go back to Ireland, but he decided to join the British Army. And he went sent to North Africa. It was a desert rat.
Desert rat, yeah.
And he was captured very early in the war.
Yeah.
And my mother received a letter from the War Office saying that he was dead in combat.
Yes.
And my oldest brother was a baby then. And she obviously got over the grieving process. I've heard similar stories. There was a lot of strange stories in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people had it really tough. Some of their stories are just... And this story is difficult to comprehend when people hear it.
Mm.
And she got over my dad.
Mm.
And my mum fell in love.
Mm.
She was still a young woman.
Yeah.
Fell in love with a Canadian Air Forceman that was based over here.
Yeah.
And out of that relationship...
Mm.
Two of my brothers were born. And then after the war, I think it was 2 years after the war, in 1947, my dad turned up on the doorstep.
Wow.
After his prisoner of war camp had been liberated.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what happened because it was kind of, it was always the elephant in the room.
Well, yes, yeah.
No one ever talked about it.
No, no.
So we were left to, I mean, me and my brothers were left to kind of fill in the gaps about how did they get back together? What happened to the other guy?
Yeah.
Did he just, you know, there was some, you know, I've always I've always thought that there was some kind of pressure from my mum's family.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, the right thing to do was to go back to my dad. And
yeah,
I don't know. It's a situation that I would never, unless you're in that situation, you wouldn't know how to resolve it, would you?
No, no, not at all.
But they always, anyway, out of their reunion, a few years later, I was born.
You were born, yeah, yeah.
In 1951.
Wow, yeah.
So that's my very early beginnings. But having said that, I mean, it was, and their relationship was very strained. It was a very, very strained relationship.
Yes, yeah.
And one of my brothers was quite affected by it.
Mm,
he always wanted to know who his dad was. Yeah, and he found out who his name was. He didn't find the guy, but
no.
He traced his name.
Yes.
And my other brother always looked on my dad,
his
stepdad, as his real dad. Because he raised him, brought him up.
Right. Yeah.
And he was, my dad was very psychologically damaged. You know, being a prisoner of war, he never talked about it. And this is quite a common discourse of people that were prisoners of war.
Yes.
They never talked about it.
No.
And of course, as you know, Jim, in those days, there was no such thing as post-traumatic stress.
No.
You would just stiff up a lip, get on with it, pull yourself together.
Exactly.
You know, and these are people that have been psychologically damaged.
I know, terrible.
Horrifically, God knows what they've seen, what they've had to endure.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, so...
So You grew up in this country, in London?
I grew up in a prefab.
Yeah.
There's a lot of prefabs in London after the war.
Yeah.
And we eventually got a council house, you know. I always look at it very cynically, you know, conquering war heroes, you know, is your council house, you know, after.
Yeah.
And that was in Clapham. So I was raised in my early days in Clapham.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely upbringing. There was and it has to be said, there was no abuse in my childhood whatsoever. No. Psychological, physical, emotional, of any kind.
Yes.
And if anything, being the youngest of four boys, I was spoiled.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, you know? That's right.
And I got fond memories of my childhood. But one thing that happened to me, whether it's significant or not, when I was five, I contracted polio.
Yeah. Well,
and in the 50s, polio was rife.
It was, I remember.
Another boy at school caught it with me, and his mum thought he had a bad fever or cold.
Yeah.
And she left it. Yeah. And my mum jumped on it straight away. And this boy died a couple of days later because his mum had left it. So it was quite soon. I spent a lot of time in isolation.
Yes, yeah.
In a hospital in Croydon, which is no longer there, called Wadden Hospital.
I remember it.
Do you remember Wadden Hospital?
We used to, as kids, because I grew up in Croydon. I'm a couple of years older, years older than Kevin. And we used to go over to see this hospital because it was out of bounds and it had a fence round it. And we were kind of half frightened about it. We didn't know who was in there. So you were actually in there.
I was in Wadden Hospital. and
wow.
It just occurred to me.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if this is significant or not, but as a consequence of having polio and experiencing a clinical environment so early in my life.
Yeah.
I used to have, quite frequently, I remember, I used to have what's called a lumbar puncture.
I remember.
Which was a massive needle.
I know, yeah.
That was used to take fluid off the spine.
Yes, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I had no fear of needles. Or anything
medical
like that.
Medical procedures.
At that early stage.
Yeah, okay.
You know, as a consequence of that.
Yeah.
And I was, and you see my contemporaries, people like, the listeners might, you know, be familiar with Steve Arley and Ian Drury.
That's right.
They were all left with withered limbs.
They were. I know Ian. Yeah.
Steve Arley's got a withered limb.
I didn't know that.
He's got quite a pronounced limb.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. One side of my body, I think it was my right side, because I found out since then for other medical procedure scans, MRI scans and things, that one of my kidneys is significantly smaller than my right kidney, significantly smaller than my left one.
Oh, right.
And that's a consequence of
polio.
Of the polio, I believe, because that's the side my polio was on.
That's right.
But my limbs, you know, were fine.
That was very fortunate. Well, look, I think it's a good time now to bring in your film. I know music's been really important in your life and still is. To bring in your first choice, and I mean, it's one of my favourite songs. I think I was talking to you before about this song, and John Lennon, who wrote this song, said it was his first really serious song. You know, and he's very proud of it. And but you've chosen the version by Johnny Cash, haven't you?
Yes, yeah.
Which is a powerful...
Yeah, it's a powerful version of it. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. So here it comes, listeners. This is Johnny Cash singing In My Life.
There are places I'll remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone, and some remain. All these places have their moments. With lovers and friends, I still can recall. Some are dead, and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all. But of all these friends and lovers, there is no one compares with you. And these memories lose their meaning when I think of love as something new. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more. I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before. I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more. My life, I love you more.
Well, that was Johnny Cash singing the great John Lennon song In My Life. I love the work Johnny Cash did, Kev, towards the end of his life, with I think it was with that New York producer. Was it Rick? Oh, somebody Rick. Anyway, he made a few albums, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he, I think personally, it was Johnny Cash's best work.
I totally agree, Jim.
Yeah. I'll just throw this in for the listeners, because this is a program about recovery and change. And my first guest, who some of you will remember, Steve Dan Mills, remembers, you know, Johnny Cash in Nashville some years ago, you know, in the recovering community. And it was, he speaks about it with a bit of sadness, really, because, you know, Johnny Cash couldn't really, you know, the people wouldn't leave him alone, you know, when they saw him at these certain meetings and that, they pursue him and want his autograph and that. And he got really, well, naturally, you know, he kind of had to travel long distances. He had to get out of Nashville to find his solace and peace, which is human nature, but it was quite sad.
I think that can be a common...
You
know,
it's a common thing, isn't it?
A common theme for so-called celebrities.
We it hasn't happened to us yet, has it? But I'm a great believer. I mean, you know, somebody said recently, your shows, Jim, why don't you get a celebrity? I said, well, haven't you been listening to my shows? Said, yeah. I said, well, I've had 15 celebrities.
Yeah.
Everyone's their own superstar.
Yeah.
You know, I think the world of celebrity is odious.
Yeah.
And everyone's got a story to tell. And some of the most remarkable stories I've heard from human beings are from people that aren't classed as
celebrities. Considered celebrities. But as you say, Jim, we are all celebrities in our own right.
Exactly. We certainly are. That's, you know, that's what A New Life's about, isn't it?
Yeah.
Self-esteem and everything. Anyway, look, Kev, just give us a summary about how alcohol... impacted on your life and times and
It's quite ironic, really, because I, like you, Jim, I come from a time and a generation, and I must say, to begin with, and you've heard me say this before, Jim, that I believe that everybody's alcoholism or addiction, whatever it is, is unique to them.
Yes.
And I don't, there's not one size fits all in recovery.
No.
And there's not one size fits all on how we get to be an addict.
No.
Right?
That's right, yeah.
I believe that each individual's alcoholism or drug addiction or whatever their addiction is, is made up, constituted by a specific amount of factors that are unique to that individual.
Yes, yeah.
Right? I.e. the factors that made up your addiction are different than the factors that make up... No two people's group of factors are the same.
No, that's right.
And and I don't know all the factors that made up mine. I don't know all the factors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really important now.
No.
But I believe one of them certainly was the environment.
Sure, yeah.
That I lived in, that was a factor. I believe the time was a factor.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And as I said earlier, I had a happy childhood. It was certainly no abuse or anything like that of any kind.
No.
So those are factors. And the reason I say that is because the time that I grew up in the 60s, in my formative years,
yeah,
and you know, our teen years are our formative years.
Yeah,
It was the time of love and peace and hippiedom, which was a great model, but it soon went. And listeners, it soon went tits up.
It did
that model.
Yeah,
you know, noble ideals, but you know, it wasn't really. In hindsight, it was never gonna.
No.
It was never gonna work.
No,
you know, and. I probably you know, experimented with every drug known to mankind during that period, and and for a long, long time, and I've heard this before, you know, in an ironic way, I used to look down on alcoholics, and I was never going to be because that wasn't my drug of, as you know, they say in fellowships. Drug of choice.
Yeah.
You know, although I always drank most of the time alongside whatever other drug I was doing.
That's right. Yes. You know. Yes, I did. Yeah.
And I was into a lot of drugs. A lot of drugs. You know, I kind of believe that lie at the time, you know, the old Timothy Leary, you know, drop out, turn on and tune in.
That's right.
And, you know, it's about, you know, opening up your mind and it's not about opening up your mind. It's just about getting high.
Yes.
That's the reality of it.
That's right.
It's just about getting high.
Yes. Yeah.
I know that now.
Yeah.
But I didn't know. Obviously, I didn't know that at the time, and I swallowed all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I was young.
Yeah.
I was naive.
That's right.
I was idealistic.
Yeah.
Which is natural when you're young.
Mm. You know, of course. Yeah.
It's healthy.
Yeah.
I think it's healthy.
Yeah, yeah. That's
you know. Right, yeah. So that's where. And as I say, I always drank alongside that, but. What happened? When my drinking took off, I guess was, and this wasn't, maybe that's another factor, but it certainly wasn't the cause. No. When I split up with my now late wife, I had this very childish concept of love. And I couldn't handle the rejection. And I thought that my concept of love was very childish, like, you know, an 8 or a 9 or a 10-year-old or even younger. And that is, if you love someone, then they must and have to love you. That's what love is. It's reciprocal. They must love you because you love them.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Well, that's okay for a child of 10.
Yeah.
You know, but not for a grown man.
No.
You know, so it's having that concept as a grown man, when you're, you know, when I was rejected, I couldn't understand it because that's not what love is, someone rejecting you, you know, and all bets were off. And I was just on,
self-destruct. Yeah.
I was on the self-destruct button.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's what I did for many years, basically.
Yes.
Everything, you know, there was nothing, you know, and a lot of people have that have known me. I mean, I'm sober a long time, like yourself now, Jim. Not as long as you, but not. I'm 29 years without a drink this year. And people that I know now that knew me in those time, which is mostly family members, said, "Well, we didn't think you were going to be around much longer."
No, that's right.
You know, we were anticipating your death.
Yeah, yeah.
At any time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a lot of near misses with,
yeah,
you know, with death, and and I survived. You know, I survived.
When did you? It obviously, you know, it progressed, and so when did you first seek help for your drinking problem?
What happened was. My family, I and my close family, my mum and, and my brothers, and specifically my mum. And I was making the poor because my mum lived with me. And I had a chance to in recovery to look after her in her later in life, which was a privilege.
Yeah.
You know, and that was my way of, it wasn't my way of making amends. It's just what you do. It's what I do. That's what love is. And they thought, specifically my mum again, that I had a problem with my drinking. I didn't have a problem with my drinking. My problem was that they had a problem with my drinking, and they wouldn't leave me alone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If they just left me alone, everything would be all right.
That's right.
So to get them off my back, I found a helpline number. Not for myself, and they asked, and they said, "Well, we can send someone around to to see you to if you want, and take you to a meeting." And I said, "No, just tell me where there's a meeting." Yeah. So I went to a meeting. Yeah, they told me where there's a meeting. I went to a meeting.
Yeah.
In Croydon.
Yeah.
St. Mary's Sunday night.
Yeah, I remember.
And
yeah.
And it didn't work because I hadn't gone for myself. I hadn't thrown in the towel.
No, that's right.
Yeah. Right, and I was sacked. I was out of work because I was like a serial sackee. I used to get sacked all the time. And I was in between jobs. Well, I wasn't in between jobs. I was out of work.
Yeah, that's a good way. I'd
been sacked again.
Yes.
It's a good way of putting it, isn't it? Yeah. I was sacked again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I remember going to my, afterwards, I came back from that meeting, the first meeting I went to, and I thought, well, it's not for me. I can do this on my own.
Mm.
I remember getting a detox.
Yeah.
Like DIY, home detox.
Oh, yeah.
And I got a job. 3 months later, that was the only time that I'd stopped drinking or drugging in my life.
Mm.
And although I was probably still doing a bit of, still drugging.
Yeah.
And I got a job.
Yeah.
And on the way to that job, the first morning of that job, I used to live in Gypsy Hill. And the train into London was 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I started generating fear and well, I was suffering from full-blown withdrawal symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And I know now that I was experiencing untreated alcoholism.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Physical aspects of untreated alcoholism. Mm. All I'd done was stop drinking.
Yeah,
I was still going into pubs, still mixing with the same people, doing all that stuff, and probably doing a little bit of puff and stuff as well.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, I got off that train and did what I always did.
Yeah.
And I just, the only defence I had was to pick up the drink.
Yeah.
That's all I knew how to do.
That's right.
To take away the fear, the anxiety, the paranoia. I mean, I was shaking physically, like withdrawal.
Yeah.
And I hadn't had a drink.
No.
So I went down to the toilets at Victoria.
Oh, no.
And I had a can of beer. I always had the beer first because if I threw up, it didn't matter because it was only beer.
Yeah.
And some Librium
from
the detox that I'd saved and a quarter bottle of brandy.
Mm.
And all the fear, the anxiety and the paranoia, everything just levelled out and peaceful.
That's right. Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is wonderful.
That's right.
This is what I'll do. Yeah. This is my plan.
Yeah.
I will just have beer
and
brandy and Librium on the way to work first thing in the morning to take away all the fear.
Mm.
And that's what I'll do. And I seriously thought that was a good plan.
Yeah.
But it was very flawed and it didn't last long.
No.
And 8 months, I lasted in that job, I don't know how, but I lasted there for about 15 months. Yeah. And then I was out, I got sacked from there again.
Yeah.
Sacked yet again. And something... I returned to that meeting that I'd been to 15 months previously.
So the seed was sown.
The seed had been sown. And this time, it was different.
Mm.
This time, as I've heard said, and I identify with it, I was sick and tired.
Yeah.
Being sick and tired.
That's right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I didn't know... And like I've read, and identify with, I didn't know how to stop drinking, but I knew I couldn't carry on drinking.
That's right.
Was at that jumping off place.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Bemused and bewildered.
Yeah.
I can't stop. What else is there in life?
No, that's right.
But I have to stop because I'm going to die.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I was spiritually dead already.
Well, yeah.
But there was some little bit of spirit there, Jim.
Amazing.
Some little bit of spirit that made me go back to that meeting.
Yes, that's right.
And after the meeting, I talked to this girl.
Yeah.
And she was 4 weeks sober.
Wow.
Fantastic. Yeah. 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And she just come out of this place, this Wallingham Park, Pennell House, which I now know is the famous Pennell House.
Sure, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And she said, why don't you go down there?
Yeah.
And this place, you didn't even need a referral.
You didn't. Tuesday
you didn't
afternoon.
Have to go to the doctors.
It's an open clinic.
And I went down there on that following Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right?
Amazing.
I was a fall over drunk at this stage.
Yeah.
I was a fall over drunk. I had a permanent black eye.
Yeah.
Not from fights.
No, just.
But from because I fell over all the time.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah.
I bumped into this girl on the bus. Nice. I'll never forget her name. Sue, her name was.
Ah, yeah.
Not seen her in about 30 years, really.
Yeah.
And I got off two stops before, and she said to me, where are you going? I said, I've got to make a phone call. And she said, well, she didn't say anything. She thought that was the last she would see of me.
Yeah.
She thought I'd bottled it.
That's right.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I got off. Yeah. I went, there was a pub at the end of that. The entrance to Pennell House, as you know, was in a road called Harrow Road.
It was, yeah.
And at the top of Harrow Road, where I got off, there's a pub.
The Harrow, yeah.
Called Harrow. The Harrow.
The Harrow, yeah.
And still I went, I got now, off there, I know I've been there, but, in sobriety.
Yeah.
And I went in the Harrow, and I had that was my last drink.
In the Harrow.
I knew the game was up. Yeah. Subconsciously, I wasn't conscious. I can remember I wasn't consciously thinking this is going to be my last drink. No, the game's up.
Yeah, yeah.
I went in there
and
I had a couple of. Subconsciously, I must have known, I think.
Yeah.
I really do believe I had.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I had a couple of drinks, a couple of large something or others. And then I walked down to Pennell House and it was the clinic there, the people that had been discharged and used to go back, like you said, every Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah.
And a guy. Came out, I was in like a queue, and he asked me who I was, and I told him who I was, and, and I'll never forget him.
Yeah.
He was a mental health nurse called Ian, smashing guy.
Yeah, I think I knew
and him. He took me in and he interviewed me.
Yeah.
And then he took me in to see the legendary Dr. Gayford.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, this is Kevin, I've interviewed him, I think we should, you know. And Dr. Gayford said, he's in.
And that was the
and that was where my recovery started, Jim.
That was, you know, the end, yet the beginning.
I was at the end, yet the beginning, and and you probably heard me share that I now know what happened to me, what I believe happened to me at that time.
Yeah,
I surrendered.
Yyeah.
To my my addiction, to my alcoholism. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And I metaphorically stuck my hands up.
That's it, yeah.
And said, that's it, I've had enough.
Yeah.
And when I did that, I got what I believe is a gift.
Yeah.
I got this gift.
Yeah.
Where it comes from, I don't know, and it doesn't now. Of acceptance.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'd admitted for years that I was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
But there's a big, there's a world of difference between the word admitted and accepted.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I used to admit to people I was an alcoholic. I know I was an alcoholic.
Yeah, I know.
But and when I accepted it, gut down level, the obsession to drink was removed. And up until now, has not returned.
And that was 29 years.
29 years ago. Hasn't returned. I've never struggled all.
No, no.
And life has happened to me, believe me.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Well, it's amazing, but I identify 100% because I've time zones are different, but I've had the same experience. Now, your second piece of music is quite apt because it's you and I. We were quite comfortably numb for a long time, and this is an amazing track by say Dave Gilmour. Well, he's Pink Floyd.
Yeah,
but. It's an amazing track from The Wall, isn't it, really?
From The Wall,
And it's Comfortably Numb. So let's play that, Kevin, shall we? Here's David Gilmour with Comfortably Numb.
Receding. just a little pinprick. There'll be no more. But you may feel a little sick. Can you stand up? I do believe it's working good. That'll keep you going for the show.
Come on, wow. So that was David Gilmour. That was Pink Floyd doing Comfortably Numb. So look, coming up to the time always always flies by in these little interviews. So really, you know, when we talk about change, Kev, because you've spent a lot of your life as a designer and in the printing world, designing. But recovery's, you know, being what it is, it's offered you new horizons, hasn't it? And I know you've been working with people with learning difficulties and disabilities, but also you're pursuing an academic path as well, aren't you? Can you like to just tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, okay, Jim. And I worked in advertising most of my life.
Yeah,
on the creative side.
Yeah.
And I used to think, I found out this is my perception as an addict, as an alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah.
That everyone in advertising drank like I did.
Mm, yeah.
But I've since found out in recovery, with a clear head and going back into advertising because I've been working for a little while, that everyone didn't drink like I did. It's just that regardless of what industry or profession I worked in, I would have gravitated towards people like-minded people.
That's right. Any of you. Same here, yeah.
And I got made redundant after 35 years or whatever in advertising.
Yeah.
And I thought, I turned that negative experience into a positive one because I went, well, you know what, they've done me a favour.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
They've done me a favour. I just lost my mum. My mum had just died, and I'd had the privilege of caring for her. She had a stroke. This is the beauty of recovery.
Yes,
right.
Yeah,
it's allowed me the people that I've loved most in the world in my life. I've been allowed to care for.
Sure, yeah.
And that was my mum and my wife.
Yeah, yeah.
And she had this massive stroke, and I cared for her at home.
Mm.
And instead of after she died, I said I wanted to go back to work full because I'd gone down to 3 days a week so I could care for my mum.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just going to work because caring for someone that's even though you love them, it can be quite. Yeah,
it's
full on, and you need going to work is almost like what's the word? It's almost like it's just a little bit of
relief.
You know, and so.
Respite,
that's the word I was going to find. It's like respite. So when I said I'd like to go back to work full time, and they said, well, don't think about it. You're in it. I thought they were being nice and considerate. And they said, you know, you're not in the right emotional space. But as it turned out, they were planning to make me redundant. That's the truth of it.
Yeah.
There's no emotion in advertising.
No, no.
You know, it is what it is, you know. They sell baked beans and cornflakes. Yeah. That's all they do.
Yeah, that's right.
It can be the sexiest car in the world. It's baked beans and cornflakes. Right.
Yeah.
It's at the hub of capitalism, for goodness sake. Let's that's be honest. Right.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I thought, well, I'll turn this around.
Yeah.
I've been in this, I'm in the position, I've got a, they've done me a favour.
Yeah, they have.
I've been in the comfort zone for years.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Just going in, I'm not being challenged.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I get a nice salary, all the bits that go with it. So I decided to, something I'd never done, I'd never educated, you know, I'd never been to university.
No.
So I decided, and a lot of my contemporaries that had got sober and had done it in their early sobriety, and I'd never done it because I'd always concentrated on service in sobriety,
and helping and others. I did that,
helping others rather than helping myself.
That's right.
Which I'm not resentful about.
No.
So I decided, so I took a degree at the Open University, and at the same time started working in the care sector.
Yeah,
I could afford to do it.
Yeah,
because it wasn't for the money.
No,
working with people with learning disabilities and autism, and it kind of turned linked in with what I was studying. I got a degree in psychology.
Yeah.
And I'm now studying, I'm doing a master's.
Yeah.
And I've got plans to do a PhD because I want to be a child psychologist. That's my ambition.
Yeah.
And during that time,
yeah.
I was reunited with the love of my life, my wife,
mm.
who I talked about earlier,
yeah.
where I've been rejected.
That's right.
And we had only been back together a couple of years.
Yes.
And she was diagnosed with a grade 4 glioblastoma brain tumor.
Yes.
Which is the most severe kind of tumour you can get.
Yeah.
And like any diagnosis of that kind, they're always out of the blue.
Yeah.
They're always on it. Who expects that kind of stuff?
No, no, that's right.
And, you know, it's funny that we should be, not funny, it's something when you think, that we should be reunited at a time when she needs someone. Mm. And I've always thought, no one could have loved her and looked after her better than I. Mm. And she was back with me.
Yeah.
And it was a privilege. Yeah, of course it was sad. Of course it, you know.
Yes. But,
and and it was such a wonderful experience. You know, I would have loved to have been with her now. That was a plan, you know, of my life. Oh, I'm back with the love of my life to spend my twilight years with her. Yeah. But it wasn't to be.
No.
You know.
No.
So it just wasn't to be.
No.
And interestingly enough, what's happened to me in my sobriety, I've known a lot of people in sobriety that have, I always say there's a spectrum of belief in God.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at it like a spectrum, a dial, there's God at one end and there's atheism at the other end.
Mm.
I came in on the God end.
Mm.
I was raised a Roman Catholic. I left it and kind of went back to that belief when I got sober.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never a great believer in the first place,
yeah.
but I've drifted away from that now, and I've, you know, I just don't have any faith, or I don't believe at all now.
Mm.
You know,
in the God that you were introduced as,
in any God, course.
Yeah,
I don't believe in any God,
but
you know, I've had that kind of I suppose it's a religious word, isn't it? Kind of an epiphany, only in the other direction.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, yeah.
So I've moved away from that. You know, I don't believe in this. It's it's God's will. I don't. It's God's will for people to live in misery and poverty and you know, wars to rage and what sort of God is that? Yeah. You know, I think it's a construct of man and womankind.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, why is God always gender specific? Why is it always a male? Right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of power stuff going on there.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a power structure. We've still got a lot of gender inequality going on.
We have, yeah.
You know, in man and womankind.
Mm. Mm.
You know, and that's I think that God, that concept of God being a male figure comes from, you know, the dawn of time.
Yeah.
When the man that really had the physical power, and I mean, you still see it now, don't we?
Mm.
We still see it now.
Yeah.
So that's where I am now, and I'm still, you know, I'm still working with people with autism, and I like to call it a term I heard, and I love it.
Yeah.
It's called neurodiversity.
Yes.
And I think we all have different wiring.
That's right.
And I said to a psychiatrist, I was with a client once, and I said. His client Chris.
Yeah.
He's 50. He's 53 years old.
Yeah.
Mm. And he's got moderate to severe learning difficulties, I would say. And and I said, Doctor, I said, Chris, I said, Chris's reality is different than my reality. Yeah. This is the way I think of people with neurodiversity. I'm neurodiverse. You're neurodiverse.
Yeah. Right? That's right, yeah.
I said, his reality is the same as someone that's blind or deaf. Their reality is different than my reality.
Of course, yeah.
But it doesn't make my reality more relevant than their reality.
No, that's right.
Yeah. Or the right kind of reality.
That's it, yeah.
It's just my reality.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And they find it more difficult to live in I believe it's Tibetan Buddhists call this world contemporary reality.
Yeah, that's what they
call it, contemporary reality.
Yeah,
people like Chris find it difficult to live in contemporary reality.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm supporting him to live in contemporary reality.
Exactly, yeah.
Because he's manifested like me in a body.
Yeah.
In this contemporary reality. Having said all that, by the way, I'm not a Buddhist. Although I have, I have looked into Buddhism.
Some of their tenets are very,
you know, I have, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and we're moving. That's the. I think there's one good, great thing about civilization here, and maybe everywhere. But all I know is here that we've become much more empathetic towards people with so-called learning difficulties. And I never forget, I went to a workshop many years ago when I was working for Barnardo's, and it was a workshop about disability. This was in the 90s when the word was new. Mm. And there was this guy, he was facilitating this workshop, and he had that, I forget the condition, it's a condition where, you know, physically you have a large head. I mean, that is the part of the condition. And he did have.
Yeah.
And his child had. And, you know, it was a what some people might call genetic, you know, they'd be derogatory about it.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, because somebody asked him towards the end of the workshop, he was a great little character, man, this guy, and he was very knowledgeable and he did a great workshop. And someone said, what about your condition, Bob, or something? He said, would you change it? He said, oh, no, I wouldn't change. He said, if there was an operation or procedure tomorrow, I'd stay the same.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And he said, because I've been blessed with this condition. He said, it's led me into so many different pathways that I would never, if I was so-called normal, I wouldn't have seen and experienced.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, I came away from that workshop with
a different
mindset.
Because it's not an illness.
No, it's not an illness, just a slightly
different,
yeah. But look, we've come to the end now. We're a little bit over time. But naturally, it's been a great chatting with you and interviewing you, Kev. And you've chose a very apt ending, haven't you, a song. And I'll leave it for you just to introduce the play-out song.
Yeah, I've chosen... for the last track on the Abbey Road Beatles, The End.
Thank you for listening, everyone, and join me next time.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.